So, I am Amelia Schoenbeck, and today is May 29th, 2026. I'm here at The Hub in Hudson with Elliot Matos, and we're about to do an interview for the Hudson Community Library of Voice and Sound. Elliot, would you like to introduce yourself in whatever way makes sense?
Sure. Elliot Peter Matos. I am about to be 54, and I'm a resident of Catskill, but I work quite a bit in the city of Hudson.
Cool. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
One place to begin is, I wonder if you might be interested in talking a little bit about where your roots are.
Well, okay. I'm a New Yorker through and through. Born in Manhattan, lived in the Bronx for the first, like, 5-6 years of my life. Then my family moved us out to Long Island, where I grew up from 7 years old till 21. And, yeah, that's where my roots are, really. Mm-hmm. My family is from Manhattan, and so we always would travel at least once or twice a month to the city, even when we were living out on Long Island. So I grew up quite a bit in the city as well, so...
I wonder if you have an early memory of exploration or play.
Ooh, that's interesting. Exploration or play, good memory. good question, actually. As it relates to coming up here, actually, we had family who lived in Middleton. And so we would travel up here quite a bit, and I always remember loving the outdoors as a kid and going with my cousins who were brothers. One was a year younger and one was a year older than me, and the three of us would always be out in the woods playing, and that's when you say exploration, I remember just always loving coming up here to, you know, the Catskill Mountains and leaving flat Long Island or the city. So I think that those are amongst my earliest memories of exploration and riding on the back of my cousin's dirt bike, and we would go through like the woods, and I remember once we cut through this old cemetery and there was these old tombstones, and yeah, I always loved that. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
I wonder if you're interested in saying a bit more about what you loved about that, whether it was a feeling or a way of relating, or just generally what it was that was enlivening to you at that time.
I remember the color green, like the different shades of green, the light green grass or the light shining on on the leaves or the evergreens or, you know, just the nature, the water, the pebbles underneath this clear water that we would just be skipping over in the back in the woods, in the backwoods, and yeah, I think there was something that drew me to that, and I think it was just the serenity of it, the sounds of the nature that I didn't get on Long Island or in Manhattan. You definitely don't get that. I mean, you know, even if you're in the middle of Central Park, you would hear the noise of the buses and the people and the cars. And even though you had serenity on Long Island and you had it was suburban, so you have also the kids playing outside and the noise, but if it was my cousin and I, the three of us, it would be just the nature. It would just be the sounds of the birds and the leaves rustling with the wind, you know. And that, yeah, that's something I always loved. And it's interesting to that you asked that, because I never really put a place to it. Why I'm here, why I've always been drawn to the outdoors, and yeah, I think that that's a really amazing question to ask and to for me to put into perspective, because from when I graduated from high school and I went to New York Institute of Technology for 2 years, where I studied hotel restaurant management, I moved to Puerto Rico, and I dropped out of college and I moved to Puerto Rico because I wanted to make sure the hotel restaurant industry was something that I really wanted to even study. So I went to Puerto Rico to work in a resort for the summer. And even in Puerto Rico, I was drawn away from the old San Juan and the city of San Juan, Santurce, and I wanted to be out in the woods and in the mountains of Puerto Rico, you know. I really like, I just love that. And then when I came back from Puerto Rico, I lived in the city for about 4 or 5 years. And then I moved to Vermont, and I was living in Richmond, Vermont. I was living in the foothills of a Camel's Hump Mountain, you know, and I had the view of my house of Mount Mansfield, and the nature that Vermont has was just, I soaked it all in. I was always out. I was always in the Huntington Gorge, or, you know, I worked for Parks and Recreation. I was, you know, like, so yeah, I think that as a kid and growing up with a family that was born in the city and had love for the city, I also had love for this, for nature and for air and for trees and water. So. Yeah.
In your young life, who were the major characters?
My family was. I grew up in a very close-knit Puerto Rican family. My mother's side of the family was a constant in our lives growing up. My cousins were major players. My sister was a major player. My mother, my father, my aunts were all major players. My grandparents were major players, even though they were sporadically in there because they stayed in the city. So it was when we went to visit them, occasionally when they came out. But, family was a major player, were the main characters in my childhood. And then as I grew up, creating the family around me with...
I can't tell whether they're inside or outside.
That's right outside.
That's right outside?
Yeah.
Well, let's see how it unfolds.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think then as I grew up, the family that I created around me, just friends from, you know, the various parts of my life that I was involved with. I was really involved with the nightclub scene in New York City. And so I built family around the whole nightclub scene. And Yeah, that was, you know, your chosen family. That was really an important thing for me, and it still is now. You know, I have my family and my chosen family, so.
Do you remember when you first encountered the term chosen family?
I was a retail clerk at a store called Rainbows and Triangles in Manhattan on 8th Avenue between 19th and 20th. It was a gay and lesbian card and gift shop. This is in 1995. And I remember some of the guys that worked there were older than me, and they had, you know, they had experienced the whole AIDS crisis of New York City. And I remember hearing that term being used in the gay community, especially amongst the people that were older. Like, this is your chosen family, and I remember hearing that, and I think that that's where, I think that that's where it stuck with me, and I was like, oh, wait, yeah, that is true, a chosen family, and what that means, yeah. That was where that came from.
I wonder if there's a person, as you were coming of age, who was the first member of your chosen family?
Well, I think as I was coming of age, I mean, if I look back at it, before I even knew the term chosen family, you know, when I was living in college and there was a close, tight-knit group of us, I would say that my friends from college became the first of my chosen family, people who I still talk to today. You know, 20 years later, who I still may not speak with every day, but every couple months we'll pick up the phone and it's like what's been going on, and there's a caring there, and there's a concern for our health and as we get older, and what's happening in our family, in our born families. So I think that, yeah, I think the people in my college at New York Institute of Technology, they were the first of my chosen family. Yeah.
I wonder what those chosen family members, what they were giving to you that was different than your biological or born family members?
Well, they would give. We all came from different walks of life, you know. I think about my friend Steve, who grew up Jewish on Long Island. You know, I grew up in the middle of the island, Central Islip, by the airport. But he grew up on the North Shore of Long Island, and it's a different economic, social background. So I think about him, and I think about how we bonded on sharing just ourselves, and hence what we learned in our own social economic differences, you know. So I think that that's a big thing for chosen family, is the different perspectives that we bring into the living situations, or the daily situations, or the school situations that we, you know, we give a different perspective, and I guess some of us are drawn more so to that, like learning about that. So, you know, it's the city boy going into the woods. You know, it's something different. It's something that I haven't experienced, and it's something that helps me grow in just knowing that it exists and just knowing that it's there in the experience of it. So I think that that's also, choosing family helps us in that aspect as well, growing, learning, you know. Yeah.
I wonder about the process of coming out. You mentioned working at the card shop at a time when you had elders who had experienced the AIDS crisis. If it was in the early 90s, you maybe were also living in and around that time.
I was living in Puerto Rico, and I called one of my college friends, and I told him, I'm gay. And he was like, yeah, I knew. I was like, oh, okay. I'm like, what do you mean? And he was just like, yeah, I kind of figured. So being able to tell someone that, and being able to vocalize it, and it being so nonchalantly accepted, and just like, yeah, so what? Like, it made me feel more comfortable coming back to the States and coming out to my family and saying it to my parents. That same person who I told from college, I came back out to Long Island after I just came back from Puerto Rico, and he had organized like all my college friends, all our chosen family, to meet at a bar. And he said, hey, Elliot has something new to tell us. And I was a little surprised because I didn't felt like I was put on the spot to come out immediately when I didn't really... Not that I didn't want to, but I didn't know how to. And I did. And it was so easily, like, everyone was so accepting of it and just so kind. And I mean, there was one person who wasn't as much. But I didn't know that until later on that I found out that they were being kind of disruptive and behind my back on it. But he and I had slept together in college, so it kind of makes sense that he was a little worried that I had come out and that, you know, it was all signs would point to him. But, you know, everyone was really accepting of it, and it was great. I mean, and that encouraged me to work in the gay community and learn more about queerness and queer theory and queer... and misogyny at the same time, because they go hand in hand, racism, they all go hand in hand, so that, you know, you start learning about these things as you're discovering yourself more. Well, you don't learn about them, they're there, but you're faced with them a little bit better. It's a better way of saying it. So yeah, I mean, it was a good experience, and I enjoyed working in the gay community. You know, it was a way to, it was in early 90s, mid-90s, you know, so it was, we didn't have gay marriage yet. We didn't have a lot of the substance that kind of exists today, so... it was different, but it was also in a way, I remember once my sister said, you secluded yourself in the gay community, and like, you're not in the family as much anymore. And I think because you get so much acceptance and so much, like, you could be really who you want to be or grow into who you want to be and learn who you want to be, that I kind of removed myself from my family where I don't have to worry about what this person thinks, what that person thinks. Or I don't have the judgments as much. There are judgments, but they're in different ways, you know. So, yeah, it was a great time of growth for me. I met my first boyfriend in the city. He was studying for he had just finished his master's, and he was studying for going for his PhD, writing towards his PhD, and that was amazing. Great experiences all around. Also not so many great experiences as well, because I mean, I really saw how racism exists in the gay community. I saw white cisgendered men who were gay use their gayness against people of color, you know, and myself being that, you know, a person of color. And it's just I also experienced that. But for the most part, it was really interesting. I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot to it. I was involved with 8th Avenue, Chelsea. Had become like kind of like an extension of the West Village, which was considered the gay area always, right? In the 70s and into the 80s, the West Village, Christopher Street, you know, that was all. But Chelsea had, the gay community had extended into the Chelsea area. Chelsea is where my family used to visit in the 70s because we had family in Chelsea. So that was the Puerto Rican area. So it had become gentrified by gay men. And then I had moved in there when it was gentrified by gay men. And I led a charge of getting pride flags up and down 8th Avenue from 14th Street to 21st Street. And I walked to every store and I asked them if they would give us some money to buy pride flags and have them put up. And we did. We had them put up. This is in 1996. 96 and 97. In 96, Giuliani had them torn down when we first did it. Yeah. And this is after we had paid for the flags to be purchased up and put them up. And we did it, you know, we just did it. We didn't go right to the city and say, we'd like to do this. So, you know, he had them torn down, but it was my first time that I had to have cameras in front of me and talk about how it's infringement on rights. Like, we're just trying to celebrate our resistance in a time where, you know, Giuliani was closing down all the gay spots, you know. So it got me into, my existence got me into politics. My existence got me into, because I became a political body, you know. Just because of my accepting of myself and saying, you know what, I love men, you know. So, yeah, that was a great experience. It was a sad experience, but a great experience at the same time. And then we had a young gay man in Wyoming get killed, Matthew Shepard, and because of where I worked, this card and gift shop in the middle of this new gay neighborhood, a lot of people from all the different political organizations would come in and buy music or cards and gifts. But here I was 21, 22, and they were telling me all these things that were happening. And I was getting politically active on it. And when we decided that we wanted to do a candlelight visual for Matthew Shepard in front of the Central Park, the entrance to Central Park West. We expected 500 people and 5,000 people showed up. And my boyfriend at the time, my first boyfriend, he and I were the first to be arrested and thrown onto a city bus. And you know, his hand was turning purple and I was screaming at the cops. And the news cameras came. They held us on the bus for over an hour. And news cameras came and my window happened to be one of the windows that were open, so I was able to speak outside with my hands tied behind my back with these zip ties. And I said, this isn't about gay rights, this is about human rights. And that video clip was played on CNN all over the world. So now my family in Puerto Rico, in Spain, they all found out that that was my coming out. I still remember my cousin in Long Island, she didn't know. My aunt, she was just like, I saw the news. I was just like, oh yeah. She's like, I love you either way. And that was really sweet, you know? But yeah, that was a crazy experience being in Manhattan at that time and being queer at that time. And yeah, I just went off on a tangent. Then you had to ask me one question. I'm so sorry.
No, it's perfect. This is the what we hope for in the process. That a question will elicit a lot of memories.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there are many questions that emerged for me, but I wonder, just because you mentioned it most recently about the vigil in honor of Matthew Shepard, I wonder just about choosing that particular location to mobilize people and to gather.
Yeah, I mean, there were multiple groups. There was the Anti-Violence Project. I remember this guy, John, from the Gay Men's S&M Association. There was the Gay and Lesbian Community Center on 13th Street. There were just so many different organizations involved. I was just the retail the guy handing out the flyers and telling everyone about it and the hype man. But I don't know why that place was chosen. To be honest with you, I don't even know. I don't think I ever found out why. But I do know that we were on the front line, and it was in front of the Waldorf Astoria, I believe is the hotel there. And then you have Central Park on the opening, and then you have F.A.O. Schwartz is here. And we're all standing there, and I remember my boyfriend and I moving, and the cops came in full riot gear, like they knew something was going to, like they wanted to instigate. They wanted something to happen. They came in full riot gear. So we moved over onto, I forget, it was 54th, maybe 53rd, and 53rd and 9th, and that's where the chief of police was all of a sudden. And he was like, I remember him saying, fuck it, start arresting them, you're coming first. And my boyfriend, his hand, like, was the one that he grabbed. And I had never had altercations with police. And that was my first time having that. I wanted to punch him. I will say now, and this is where, and I don't know if it's my demeanor, or if it's me. I don't know. The great thing about this was we were all taken down to Central Booking in Lower Manhattan, and they had, I want to say, there were maybe 80 men in this one cell, and it was very somber. It was very, and people were like, don't say your name, and don't give them your information. Like there were people who were from ACT UP, from what was the other group, from Cree Nation, that were all in the, and they were telling people like how to, they were activists, and they were telling us how to do these things, how to, what to say and what not to say. But it was a somber moment, and everyone's silent. And then some queen stood up and said, "Now, who chose the color of this place?" And everyone just started cackling. And it was like, all of a sudden, it was like the air became light. The room became light. Like, people started talking. Sylvia Rivera was in that room, and she stood up, and she talked. And it was just like, it was one of the last kind of speeches that she would give in the room. It was just amazing. It was like absolutely an amazing moment, from a moment that was scary, from a situation that was scary, from a situation that was sad for Matthew Shepard, you know. Yeah, it was an amazing moment for that experience alone, you know. They let us all go. We never got booked for anything like that. But shortly afterwards, I moved to Vermont. And my boyfriend and I moved to Vermont. And I got involved with Vermont Pride. And we were the first Pride committee when Vermont had passed its own civil unions. And then we were on the last, I was on the last Pride committee when they passed gay marriage outside of the Supreme Court. So, you know, I was in these pivotal moments for queer rights. It's a pretty amazing thing, you know.
Do you remember anything Sylvia Rivera said in that?
I do. I remember her saying, she's like, this is not my first time in this room, in this cell. She's just like, I've been doing it for how many years? And, you know, she said the years. And I remember standing up and I was like, whoa, like, who is he? You know, like, not knowing, like, and then learning and then even like, oh my gosh, that's who it was, you know? Yeah, I remember her saying that was not her first time in the room, and this was not her first fight, and it wasn't going to be her last. And I remember that. I remember that, like, there was more to it, I believe, but I'm sure. But those are the things that I remember with her saying. So, yeah. Yeah.
You talked a while ago just about finding community and chosen family within, like, the nightclub world in the city at that time. And I wonder if you could just tell me a bit about that scene.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to when I was in college on Long Island. Dance music had taken a turn, and I grew up in a family that went to Studio 54, went to Paradise Garage, went to these iconic nightclubs, the Latin Quarters. So I grew up, when my family had family over for family parties, records were always constantly being played, and these new records were coming in, and I remember being a teenager going down to visit family in the Bronx and Coney Island, and breakdancing. The music had turned, and there was more electronica, there was more African Mabada. It was like these electro kind of sounds, Mars, and breakdancing was combined into it. So dancing was always like this form, especially in Latin culture, the salsa and merengue. So I grew up with dancing. Dancing was part of it, right? So as I was becoming of age and going to college, we would sneak out, all of us at the college, we would go out to these clubs on Long Island, and I was drawn to obviously what would be kind of queer minded in lots of ways. So it was like this industrial sounds from Chicago, and from that came the house music sounds of Chicago. But then also, like, the disco of New York was also infused into it. So I just started going out to these clubs and to these raves and meeting people who were from all walks of life again, and even learning even more and hearing different more different stories. And it was it drew me in. And when I left for Puerto Rico and came back, when I was in Puerto Rico, a group called the CNC Music Factory had performed out there, and I met the two guys who were part of it, and I don't remember what happened, but it was at this club called Crash. It was a nightclub in Santurce called Crash, and I just fell in love with the sound and the music and the vibe that was going on. And when I came back to New York, I got involved with the house music scene, and it was late night, it was all night, it was till the sun came up in the morning. With some beautiful, amazing people, some sketchy characters, of course. But even the sketchy characters had these stories to tell, and it was a great experience. I'm still involved with the dance music scene. I moved from Vermont in 2008, and I went to Amsterdam, the Netherlands. I had a friend who had moved from Vermont to Honduras. When she and I lived in Vermont, we would go partying in Montreal. But then we would also do, like, Buddhist retreats. And she had moved to Honduras. She met a boyfriend at the time who was French, and they got a boat, and they took the houseboat from Honduras to Amsterdam. And they settled outside of the of Amsterdam in a city called Weesp. And I wanted to... Vermont, I love Vermont. I love the politics of Vermont. I love the people in Vermont. But you get your first blizzard in the week of Halloween, and you get your last blizzard in April or sometimes even May, your last nor'easter. It was too long, and the winters were too long, and I was getting seasonally depressed in January and February to the point where I was getting suicidal. And in 2005, maybe 2006, I can't even recall, the club I had been working at closed down. I lost my job with the Parks and Recreation, and the winter was just really, really long and hard. And I was like, if I don't get out of here, I'm not going to live. So I wanted to start making a plan to move to Germany because I was so into house music and techno. I was like, oh, Germany's kind of like a mecca for that. Let me go to Germany. But a friend of mine, Samantha, she said, you should check out Amsterdam. She's like, that's where I'm at, and they speak English here, and there's a great music scene, and it's really close by to Germany. And I was like, okay. So I came out there, I stayed on her houseboat for 3 months. I wasn't supposed to stay there for 4 months because of my visa, but I did. And then I came back, I sold everything I had, and I moved to Amsterdam. I stayed there using the Dutch-American Friendship Treaty, which is a treaty that the Dutch and the Americans drew up in 1957, maybe 1962, that allows any American with, at the time, I think it was like $5,000 or $6,000 in their bank account to stay there for 5 years and watch your business grow. So I started a business doing marketing distribution. So that means like flyer and magazine distribution. And I did it just for LGBTQ magazines and businesses. And that took me every month. I would travel around all of Holland, all of the Netherlands, parts of Belgium, and parts of Germany. And every month I would just drive around and like hand out all these things. And it was really amazing. And I DJed quite a bit. I don't even know why I got there. What was your question? the club scene. So, yes. So, I met this wonderful gentleman there in Amsterdam. He's French. And he and I became best mates. And we started doing events for this party called... It's a party. It's a festival called the Amsterdam Dance Event. And it is now one of the leading music conferences. So people in the music, dance music industry go there every October. So we started by doing one party and then doing two parties. It's a five-day festival. And now it got up to the point where we were doing around two or three parties a day in over... five or six venues for those 5 days. We brought boat parties, we did rooftop parties, we done it all. In museums, like, we were really thinking out of the box than most of the people in the ADE, regular ADE. And now there's a team of people who do it. I gave it all, he passed away a few years ago, and my heart is right now in working for what I do here, which is Hudson Casca Housing Coalition, and tenants' rights and the Black Liberation. And my heart wasn't into doing the parties without him, so I give it to all the people that we have been working with as our DJs and producers, and now they take care of it, and they do it. Yeah, it's pretty amazing to see something that you start have a life of its own, and it's moving in a very successful way, you know. And it's with the message too. I mean, when I started doing them with Benjamin, there was no gay representation at the Amsterdam Dance Event. And we felt like there should be a gay representation. And the people who started it weren't very happy about what we were doing. They thought that we were putting a spotlight on something that can be ridiculed and judged. But that ended up making them happy. And they were like, love what you guys are doing now. We see this. I started a party called Women of House because we recognized that only 3% of the names on flyers were women. Meanwhile, they made up more than 50% of the DJs available. And then I did a party called The Sounds of Blackness because another thing that we noticed was everyone was becoming these white DJs, and we're like, what happened to the Black queer history of house music? Yeah. So now they're going on. Yeah.
Awesome. I wonder, just as a way of starting to think toward a bridge between there and here, if you could talk a little bit about how spending time, like, in the club scene and the dance scene formed your politics, whether it did.
No, it definitely did. I mean, I was living in the Netherlands amongst a culture of people who were the first to begin slavery. As we know it, as in the African realm, you know, I didn't recognize that when I was living in the city and I was younger, I was even the best man for a South African man. And it wasn't until I moved to Vermont and I was still speaking with him that I started recognizing how his thoughts on black people. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, like, you're racist. Like, not that he saw it, but it was there. And I didn't see it until I moved away from him. And then I was able to give a wider scope and look at it and be like, oh, that's where that's coming from. Then I moved to the Netherlands, not thinking about how South African and the connection between South Africa and Amsterdam. And then I get there and I'm like, oh, this is a culture based on we're better than you. And so my politics started growing in the city, being gay, coming to Vermont, and, you know, even the most backwards person in Vermont is politically involved. Vermont is a socialist state because of that. It's history. It's embedded in people. It's in their blood. Whether it's coming from the French who went down from Montreal, or is the people who from Vermont when it was not part of the original 13 colonies, you know, there was something in Vermont called Town Hall Day, and it's a Tuesday, and everyone goes to Town Hall Day. You know it, right? So this is, and it was, and you know, me coming from Manhattan, from in Long Island, that did not exist, or it didn't exist the way it does in Vermont, where it's in your face, like everyone does it. It's just like, okay, they look at you strange if you're not involved in it, right? So it, for me, was a great eye-opener. I worked at a food co-op called the Onion River Food Co-op, and it became City Market. You're familiar with it. I was the assistant general, member services director. My member services director, the person who was above me, the member services director, he was from Vermont, and he was so tight-ass, like such a tight-ass guy. And the co-op had more of a free-flowing kind of vibe and energy, and we talked about an issue and we tried to work around an issue, and he was not like that. But because he was not like that, and I flew in with the whole kind of hippie kind of side to it, I had to talk with Bernie Sanders when we were going into the downtown market. Like, I had to come meet with the members who were the hippies, and that also gave me so much education and so much learning. And so when I left Amsterdam and I came here back to the States, I could have moved to Vermont or I could have moved back to Long Island, and I didn't want to do either. Vermont because of the winters, Long Island because of the political climate, how stringent and so red and not where I want to be, even though my family's there. So my friend who made me come out to all my college friends lived in Catskill, and he was like, come to Catskill, and I was like, let me check it out. And I fell in love with it here. So I came here, didn't have much money when I came back. So I was like, let me do something where I can get a car. So let me work for a taxi service. So I started working for a taxi service so I could bring the car home and everything like that. But that led to me doing medical transport for Kasaki Logistics. And that led me to drive all over Columbia and Greene County and meet people and meet so many veterans and bring them up to the VA hospital and listen to their stories as Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were fighting for that Democratic ticket And I would hear men in their 60s say, if it's Bernie, I might vote for him. But if it's Hillary, I'm going to vote for Trump. And I was like, whoa, Bernie and Trump are two different sides. But I can see it because they're both talking out of the box. They're both talking completely different stories, but completely out of the box. So, and then I started recognizing that there was an energy here with that. There are people up here that really care and they really want to do better. But just like the Dutch, there's this racist undertone that we don't recognize, that they don't see, but it's not something that they want to be. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't know. It's it was really an eye-opener for me to work as a medical transport driver and to experience the culture up here. Not only that, but then to drive around and see the Dutch culture of up here and see, like, these A-frames that are very much Dutch, or these windows, like, go to Kinderhoek, and you hear these names and you see the houses and you're like, this is all Dutch. And it was really amazing for me. I love it. You know, I absolutely love it. And it brought me to the point where I recognize that all these experiences that I have, I can help utilize that to help other people's voices be heard because of those experiences. I can listen to people. I'm a very good listener, and I can be their bullhorn, because a lot of people won't listen to people who they grew up with, that they grew right next door to. So I can help lift their voices up. So that's what I try to do in a very humble way. But, you know, I'm a Leo too, so. Leo too, so. Yeah, my ego can't get into it. But yeah, that's what I have for you.
I wonder if you could just tell me about the work you do here in and around housing advocacy.
Yeah, so in 2020, during the pandemic, a lot of things happened. I was part of starting a food pantry. With this woman named Megan Henry, who had just moved up here from Pennsylvania, I believe, at the time, but she's no longer here. But she started this food pantry. She was working for the Casco Community Center. I wanted to do... So I was always involved with parades and marches and things like that. So I wanted to do a march, but I didn't want to do a gay march. I wanted to do something that was not focusing on gay and focus on just everyone. So in March 8th of 2020, I did a diversity march. The following week, we went into lockdown. The diversity march was amazing. A lot of people showed up. We all convened at the community center. And that's where I learned about the food pantry starting up. Next week was the lockdown, so the food pantry became an essential thing for families. We went from the March, end of March, serving 11 families a week, to the end of September, serving around 57 families a week. So it had grown essentially, right? And then... from there, I also had got the job working with I was doing medical transport. So, I think we wanted to start a micro farm in the village of Casco, and I had a woman come up to me and she's like, "I'm a neighbor of where you're going to put this farm." She said, "What kind of people are going to be on this farm?" And I was like, "What do you mean by what kind of people?" She's like, "Well, I want to know, like, you know, who's going to be showing up on this farm? And I found it incredibly racist, and incredibly hoity-toity. If that's a word. I'm trying to think of the other word, but I can't think of it right now. But elitist. And I started vocalizing about that online because that was our way of communicating to the community during the pandemic was social media. And people from HCAC, these are people who were from Hudson and Casco, born and raised, generational, saw what I was saying and they liked it. And they asked if I would become part of the organization. But at the same time, if I can say this, at the same time, I had just gone won a scholarship to finish my towards my bachelor's degree at Bard College. So I was like, well, I can't join right now because I just started college again. But I only have 2 years to go. It was even less, a year and a half. But so I did my studying for human rights at Bard College. And then I started working with the Hudson Casco Housing Coalition, which is a tenants' rights group. And they do tenants' rights and on the crust of also criminal justice. Because, you know, a lot of people come out of jail and prison and aren't able to get housing as well. So, like, it all is intertwined and interconnected. So, I started doing that, working for the organization as a Casco organizer. But my skills have always been in organizing being a little bit more not an organize being organized rather than organizing. I can throw in a party because I know how to do a checklist. So they started seeing that I was better at that, and then I moved into management position, and now I'm the managing director. Yeah.
There are like a number of things that I would still love to talk about, and I'm gonna check our time, but I'm sort of aware.
Do we need to do part two?
I mean, yeah. As we were talking, I was thinking like maybe this is.
Yeah, I don't mind doing the part two. Yeah, I don't mind talking about this. Yeah.
Cool. But I just want to make some time as we sort of, you know, lean toward the end of this conversation, at least. If there's anything that I haven't yet talked about that you like really had on your mind as wanting to get into, if not, I can.
I mean, I guess no. I feel like I've touched on a lot of the things. We could go into them deeper, like the things about the differences between Hudson and Casco is a big difference, but there isn't. And in my studies at Bard, I learned so much about how Hudson and Casco are interconnected. And I love to talk about that. I also love to talk about, I think what I would also like to talk about is the current state of Hudson. And this block right here is an old block full of generational people. And this building was built by the hands of people who lived on this block. And now this is owned by the college that I went to in 2010. Bard College now owns this building. And I think that it's something to be recorded for historical references, the experiences that I have experienced as a student of Bard and now as a tenant of the college that I went to.
Yeah, I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, right now? Yeah, yeah.
If that's all right with you.
Yeah, then. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, Bard College was an amazing experience for me. I enjoyed being an elder in a room full of 18 and 21-year-olds who were like, you knew Sylvia, you met Sylvia Rivera. Like, it was just amazing to share that. And then also learn about how, And this is something I never really learned about how the Spanish and the English, the British, I should say, the Spanish and the British and most of Europe had these gender, these ways of using language to differentiate gender and how it was became so binary. Whereas brown cultures from the Aboriginal to the Africans and the different nations of Africa and then the Caribbean and the native indigenous people of Americas, that didn't exist. Gender was, there was no he and she. It was a myriad of different genders. And you're talking about all the way across the world in these brown and black cultures. And in Bard, I learned that. And I learned how my own queerness allows me to say I'm he, they, because I'm very masculine presenting, but I'm queer. And there's, I'm obviously in touch with my feminine, you know what I mean? Like, and my feminine is in touch with me, and I'm, and I love that, and I want to celebrate that. But we're living in a culture where I'm not allowed to celebrate that, because we're, it goes all the way back to this Western European idealism of gender. And Bard showed me that. Bard, the teachers at Bard showed me that. The teachers who were teaching biology and chemistry at Bard showed me that, as well as the teachers who were doing women's studies and humanities, and the humanity classes. Like, I learned that, even from the students. So, all of a sudden, here I am part of a housing tenants advocacy group in Hudson with this gentleman, gay gentleman, white gay gentleman, who owned all these properties. And then he, for some reason, and we, you don't know why, he gives it to a college, not to the people of the city, but to the college that I went to. And then that college that I went to is holding it and not acting in the way that its ethos is. And it's just like, and it's shocking to me. But it's not shocking to me because I lived in Holland and I saw how that culture can be. So it's not that shocking. But it's sad for me to see that with this ethos, with this college that has taught me about gender and otherism, that it acts in the same kind of colonialistic ways that I was learning against at it. So, here I sit in this building, you and I are in this room, that now we don't know our fate in it. We don't know what the college wants to do. We don't know if the college is going to sell it behind our backs and push us out. They weren't communicative. They sat in a recent meeting on their properties with the mayor, and I sat in that room, and there was a gentleman who I met when I was going to the college, and now he's saying that he works for the foundation that owned the buildings, Galvin Foundation. So now he's saying that he works for Galvin. I'm like, no, you're an employee of Bard. That's how I met you. And it's just so weird, like this. It's becoming frustrating, and it's sad to the people of Hudson, because you just want people to become, to be on the level. You want them to speak with clarity and to be honest and say, hey, we don't know what's going to happen. We're still trying to figure it out. Please bear with us. Like, say something like that. Be honest. Be open. Instead of, oh, we can't talk about that. And it's just like, well, I don't know. It's just. And then you have the, I'm sorry, I'm going on a tangent, but you have the president who was just found on the Epstein files, right? Who knew this when I was going to college. It was known, right? But he downplayed it so much. He never said, oh, I was going to his ranch, to his island. He downplayed it so much. We only talked about loans, about money for the college. Well, if that board and those lawyers are the same ones who advised him to keep his mouth quiet, or the same ones who are advising, which whatever this foundation is now that owns these buildings, then I can't trust that. We can't put the people of Hudson can't put their trust on that, because they're illy advising the spokespeople or whatever. I don't know. It just doesn't seem fair. Doesn't seem right. And it's worrisome. So yeah, that's where I'm at with that. I feel like it's a shame to see this. And you know, to be honest with you, as soon as we found out that Bard got this building, I called the Center of Civic Engagement, because I was really heavily involved with the Center of Civic Engagement on the Bard campus when I went there. And I was just like, you guys should come in and rent some rooms from us and activate the students in here. Like, that's what we do. And they were like, yeah, we would love to do that. Let's see what's going to happen. But then it was dropped off, and I'm just like, it's just a shame. It's like, the college doesn't even want to listen to its alumni on how to move in a community that the alumni are part of, you know? And that's a shame. That's a big shame. So
I really want to pick up on something that I've heard throughout the interview and that you also made evident just as you were talking, which is this thread of just experiences within communities that were in some way liberative, that were also like subject to the really broken forces of our culture. Mm-hmm. You know, like for instance, like experiencing a lot of openness in the gay community and experiencing racism in the gay community and experiencing like a certain type of freedom in the dance music community and also seeing the hypocrisy within that community. And then this again with the dynamics at Bard, like feeling and experiencing one set of things as a student there and also seeing the college fail to live up to its ideals.
Right.
And I just wonder how you think about those contradictions within these communities.
I often use a word that makes people of fairer skin uncomfortable, and that's whiteness. And whiteness is not the color of the skin. It is the idealism that Western European has ingrained into cultures around the world. Even black and brown cultures have whiteness to them, where they idolize whiteness, where they idolize, and it could go from the skin to, oh, you're speaking too loud. That's whiteness. That's whiteness when you, you know, yeah, there's different aspects of it, but, the college, Bard College, acts in whiteness. What it's doing is acting, the white cisgendered males and the misogyny that exists in the gay community. People don't understand, straight people don't even recognize it as much, but there is so much misogyny in the gay world. You can look at Will and Grace today, watch the show, and you will see how misogynistic it can be, right? And people don't pick, they celebrate it, they laugh at it, they think it's funny, but it's not. It's male whiteness being ingrained and drilled into us in a way that you don't even recognize it, and you celebrate it and you laugh at it, and it's actually harmful. And it's something that my experiences have shown me that. Like, it's something that, like, living in Vermont, you know, like, Vermont is such a beautiful liberal, and I will still say I love the people of Vermont. But it can be incredibly white. It can be incredibly white, and in its, and you know, your behaviors are policed, I noticed that with my experiences, how whiteness is, and I try to speak up about it, even amongst friends. And it's sometimes even hardest amongst friends because they'll still get so defensive. And I'm like, I'm not speaking about you. Like, you know, like, I'm speaking about, like, how you're fighting me right now on this. You know, but, yeah, that's, you are right. It is a thread in my life, and it's, I'm seeing it now. But I also have been more vocal about it now than ever. And I love that aspect of it because, I kind of have a right to. I have that right to say it. I have those experiences and how it's harmed. And when Giuliani closed down those sex stores on 42nd Street, and he Disney-fied 42nd Street, it put all of the people that I was hanging out with or I knew on the streets. They became homeless. They became, they didn't have places to hang out at during the day. They didn't have safe spaces to hang out at during the day. They lost money from whatever way that they could make it. It was harmful, but it was directly targeted towards black and brown queer people. And white men did nothing for that. White men did not stand up for that. They were fighting whether they can get adopt. Meanwhile, people were trying to live and trying to get food on their mouths. And the white and gay men were worried about, I want to get married and adopt. And it's just like, damn, we wish we can worry. Those were the worries, things we could worry about. And they didn't see that. And when we were telling them that, they were, oh, you're being dramatic, you know, and like this queenie, like wave of the hand. And I'm like, it was harmful. It was harmful. But we still partied and we still had a good time. We still made the best out of life and we still stuck together and we still fought on the streets and we still, tomorrow I'm going down to see Cats. Those are the bitches that I was hanging out with on the streets. Those are the queers that we were hanging out on 42nd Street. Those are the same people, like, and now they're on Broadway. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's always ways that we strive, and there's always ways that we get around it. But it takes so much longer. And if we had white gay men and white lesbian women behind us, it wouldn't take that long. And when we say, don't put a sign on your thing on the All Lives Matter here or Black Lives Matter here, don't do that if you're not working at it every single day. You have to work at it every single day. And that's the only way that change is going to come. And they don't want to hear that. Oh, they don't want to hear it. When I say, please don't vote for the middle of the road people, like, let's go Mandami. Oh man, I can't tell you how many gay men were against Mandami. They were so against him. But look what he's doing. He's changing that city around. I'm hoping that he stays in the... I was a little upset with the Governor Hochul endorsement, but he's doing good things. We need that. And when we say that to our gay, white gay counterparts, they get so defensive. And it happens in the Netherlands too. I have a few gay white Dutch friends that I still keep in touch with, and I tell them, and they're like, oh, you're always stuck on that. Oh, you're so American. You're so stuck on the racism. I'm like, of course I'm stuck on the racism. Like, that's the core of it. That's the otherism is what I'm talking about. It's that otherism. And they don't understand. They don't get it. They don't get that. When I would go to these gay clubs in Amsterdam and there would be Asian people in the club, they would, oh, it's Chinatown in here. And they would say it but so loudly and so nonchalantly and so... like, oh, it's a joke. But no, you're harmful. These you're talking about the Indonesian countries that you guys that you guys overpowered and that you guys still hold as colonies. Like, you don't understand that. They really don't get it anyway. But yeah. I I am happy for the experiences I've had, and I'm happy that I am able to bring them into my daily life and also do the work myself, because I grew up with privilege as a Puerto Rican guy whose father was worked at Intimates for 35 years on the floor making donuts, and my mother was a lipstick woman at Esplorada factory making, you know, burned her hand once. I still grew up privileged. I grew up in a neighborhood that was black, Italian, Irish, Jewish, you know, and that was privilege. That we were able to drive up here to the mountains and I was able to go into the woods, that's privilege. And I know that. I know that I was able to go to college and then not drop out of college. And, you know, like, that's privilege. And I'm trying to use that push for good and also work on myself in that as well. So that's what we all need to do. But yeah.
Thank you for that. Do you have a little bit of time, briefly, for one last question?
Sure.
I can also tell you what time it is. You can check.
What time is it? Oh, my phone just restarted, so.
It's 5 minutes before four.
Okay, yeah.
Or we can also put it on the file to reconvene.
And that would be really nice to do reconvene.
Yeah.
I would love to reconvene. Yeah. Okay. It's been 4 hours now, so.
Yeah, totally. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For this conversation.